Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Show Straight Down the Middle with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed, Senior Teaching Professional at Stoke Park Golf and Country Club, and Jeremy Dale, PGA coach and switch hitting trick shot artist. What a performance at the Canadian Open from Rory McIlroy.
He was out of this world. I mean, it was awesome to watch Rory in full flow. You know, he's on 59 watch, eagle 17, hitting driver 7-iron to 2 feet, taps it in. And then he's sitting in the middle of the fairway on 18. All he has to do is hit an iron into the middle of the green and he's got a chance of 59. But unfortunately, pushed it into the right-hand trap, made bogey, but 61 with an 8-shot victory. I mean, it was an absolutely stunning performance.
Speaking after the competition, he of course said that he was disappointed not to shoot that final round 59. Tongue-in-cheek, or does he really hold himself to that kind of standard?
Yeah, I think he does. You know, I think he's when he's on form, he is the best player in the world. And, you know, in some ways, it can often be a curse to make the game look so easy. He's made the course look easy. He's made the game look easy. And now people actually expect that from him all the time. But I think also, you know, he's a victim of his own success in that way. He expects the same standards of himself. But he now goes into the next two major championships in some of the best form we've ever seen from him.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this has been coming for a long time. Last year, I read in about August that he said, I haven't hit a fade for 4 months. And it was interesting to hear him talk like that. And I think he became a little bit one-dimensional. And guys who are good at driving very often aren't good at wedges. And you could characterise Rory's game exactly like that. And I think for the last 8-9 months, he's been working on moving the ball left to right. And he's had some absolutely stellar performances. He won the TPC and it was very noticeable because of top tracer and also the aim of his feet was way left at TPC, hitting lots of fades. And I think that's really helped his wedge control, which was brilliant yesterday. And once you start fading the ball, wedge game becomes easier. And I think it's something that he realised last year and he's put right. And OK, he hasn't won a major for 5 years. And I think that was he was feeling like he got left behind and he wanted to become a more multi-dimensional player, and I think he's really achieved it now. And yesterday was fantastic, a week too early perhaps, but even so, he's the kind of player that can do that.
And in addition to what Jeremy's saying there, you know, Rory came to Rory's attention. He was ranked outside the top 200 in the distance 75 to 100 yards.
I've got the same problem.
It just takes you more shots to get there. He, you know, he put some work into his wedge game and he put an extra wedge in the bag for the week in Canada. And obviously there was a huge difference in his quality of wedge play. You know, as Jeremy said, he's working the ball from left to right more often so he can control the club face a lot better. But also he's actually practicing those disciplines. And given how far he hits the ball, he's going to have those shots all the time.
Yeah, it was interesting to see yesterday, actually, he did start to move the ball right to left as well, I thought, and then came unstuck on the last couple of holes, trying to draw one into a flag. And good that he's going to try and do both. I mean, TPC, he very much was for the fade, and this time he was obviously trying both, and it worked beautifully.
Well, we've heard your assessment of his performance. Let's hear how Rory thought he got on at the Canadian Open.
You know, I played with so much freedom over the weekend, you know, more freedom than I've had for a while, which is, you know, exciting because I've been able to win this tournament, but also exciting for, you know, what's coming up and what's ahead.
How important do you think that feeling of freedom is, the ability to play with less pressure?
I think as far as Rory's concerned, a huge amount. I think most of the pressure that Rory faces, he puts on himself. The press hammer a lot of pressure on him, like I said, for reasons discussed before. But I think playing freely allows Rory to play into a rhythm, which he's more accustomed to. I think that when there's stop-start rhythm and it's in a setup and a course that doesn't really suit him, I think he struggles. He's definitely a momentum player. And the important thing now is that he takes a great performance into a major championship riding that momentum.
He's also a guy that you want to watch and want to play like. And there's very few like that where you go, okay, I really want to I really want him to win because I love the way he plays. I mean, you look at very few players who like that. I wouldn't watch Dustin Johnson or Brooks Koepka in the same way. But the freedom that Rory brings to the game and the exuberance almost and the walk and the very few guys have that charisma. And I think he's easily the most talented player of his generation.
With that, it's not just the system that's been stopped to start. His form has been quite inconsistent as well. Given how talented he is, and Tom, I know you've played against him, why hasn't that success been more consistent?
I think a lot of it comes down to what goes on outside of the golf course for Rory. He's had issues with his personal life, with management companies and relationships. And I think he's actually reached a milestone in his life where he's happily married and settled. He's changed equipment manufacturers into golf clubs and a golf ball that he feels very comfortable
with.
Which
is more unsettling, being uncomfortable with your golf club or uncomfortable with your girlfriend?
It's got to be the girlfriend, doesn't it?
It could be golf club, I don't know.
No, well, imagine having both.
Yeah, very true.
Quite right. And I think that was where he was when he was with Wozniacki. Back in the day, and I think now he's at a stage where he just seems more comfortable in his own skin, more relaxed, more content, and I think that his best years are ahead of him.
Would you agree with that assessment, Jeremy?
Well, he does things in bursts. He's always done this. When he won two majors in a year, he had a really quite ordinary first start of the year, and suddenly he came good, and he wins in short bursts, and it looks like he's on one now, and he's timed it beautifully. I mean, with two majors to go, who knows what he can do? But I just think he's just the best watch that there is, and I just hope he keeps going like he is. It's fantastic to watch.
Wonderful stuff. And of course, he wasn't the only Northern Irish golfer to have a good day out.
That's right, GMAC. I mean, he came good. Obviously, he's pushing hard to make sure that he can get himself into the British Open as he's moved further outside of the top 100 of the world rankings, and he's not quite secured his place in the British Open of his hometown. And he bombs in a 30-footer on 18, which, just for you stat geeks at home, had a 3% chance of going in on PGA Tour averages. So he knocks that one in, secures his place in the British Open with a big fist pump, and it's another clutch putt hold by McDowell on
which
the 18th green.
Which is going to be played in his hometown. I mean, he grew up and still lives in Portrush, so what a great story. But it just also highlights the ups and downs of the game. I mean, it is a brutally hard game, as I think we're going to discuss later when we come to Thomas Bjorn. But think of Graham McDowell, you think of major champion, US Open winner, and the guy that hold the putt for the Ryder Cup, and you go, well, what could possibly go wrong? And actually, things do go wrong, and they lose their form, and they have to fight their way back again. And he's worked very extensively with Carl Morris, a golf psychologist, and with his coaches, and clawed his way back so that he now has a chance. Won a tournament earlier in the year. But everybody thinks that the course of golfing life runs smooth. All you've got to do is, you know, turn professional, pull on your sponsored red trousers, hit a few massive drives down the fairway and wave at the crowd. And it can be like that, but it's not always. And Danny Willett is another one. He's plumbed the depths and hit the great heights as well. So these guys, they never get to own golf. They just borrow it for a bit and then they have to give it back.
Even Tiger Woods.
Exactly, yes.
I think a lot of the best players in the world have suffered dips in form. I mean, you look at Lee Westwood, Martin Keimer. These are guys that have reached world number one and then moved outside the top 200 in the world and have now regained some of the form. And I think it's a combination of actual technical form, but also the off-course antics that some of them experience as well. But it's awesome to see Graham McDowell back. And as Jeremy said, he has been an amazing clutch putter and clutch player, and especially during Ryder Cup. So I expect him to go on from this. He's got a full schedule coming up, including both major championships. So, you know, he's won the last US Open at Pebble Beach too. So, you know, why not a repeat performance?
It would be quite something. We'll, of course, be previewing the whole of the US Open later in the show. But just as a final word on Rory McIlroy, Tom, I know you played against him when he was but a wee lad. Was it obvious even then how far he could go?
Yeah, I mean, he would hit the ball far for a young lad, because at the time I was 18, he was 15. So I was physically a lot bigger than he was just through age. And he hit the ball the same distance as me. He didn't talk to me much. He just got on with his game. I probably underrated how good his short game was. That was what impressed me the most. But he was a very polite, respectful lad. And you could see that he was just a bit special. I mean, he looked different. You know, he had the big curly hair. At the time, he was wearing these massive sunglasses that looked like he was just finished the Tour de France. But he had an air of charisma about him. And he is, as Jeremy said, he is one of the most exciting players to watch.
Watching a game which at its most exciting is fantastic, but people are still tweaking it, finding other formats that can bring more joy, perhaps bring more people in as well. Coming up, let's talk golf sixes. Is it good for golf?
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to Straight Down the Middle here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed and Jeremy Dale. And let's talk about golf sixes. Is it good for the sport? Jeremy, just explain a little bit about how this format works.
16 teams, pairs, and it was like a bit like a World Cup or a European Championships in football. You had pools of four, which led to qualification to a quarterfinal, semifinal, and final. All the matches were six-hole match play, but the format was greensomes, which means that both tee off, you choose the best one, and then you play alternate shot from that point on. And so you have these six-hole matches with pairs, and they're all from different countries. And there are a couple of women's teams in there as well, most notably England and Germany. The Germans actually beat the Australians. The German women beat Australian men. I think that was the only match that the women won. But an interesting tournament, and played at Oitavos Dunes in Portugal, which, of course, I know well. Is it good for golf? Yes, I think it is. Did it really work? Not quite sure. There wasn't really many people there. I didn't think they used the best holes on the golf course either as a spectacle. It didn't quite have the atmosphere, perhaps, that they would have wanted. It didn't have the best players there. The best players were Tong Chai JD, who was part of the winning Thailand team. Jamie Donaldson and Tom Lewis were also there. So good names, but not the best players. And I like the idea of golf having a 2020, but I'm not sure, again, why they would do it now in the middle of major championship season.
Do you think it's distracting from majors?
Well, I think they just can't get enough attention on it. Everybody's busy watching Rory shoot 61 to win the Canadian Open. It's the US Open next week. The focus is not on it. In the old days, back in the 80s, they used to use really old, different formats, rather, at the end of the season. We had the old Dunhill Cup, which was teams of three from each country, played at the old course. Again, played the same sort of system, match play to a concluding final. In the 30s, the PGA Championship was the match play major. It was all played on match play. And then we had the match play, the Suntory World Match Play in the 80s at Wentworth as well. And the European Tour are really trying to get new formats into the game. They've got this innovation swing, they're calling it. They had the Belgian knockout a couple of weeks ago, followed by the sixes, and followed by Made in Denmark, which is a stroke play tournament, but they've got different things, like the players have to walk through a pub from one green to another, which is quite nice.
Is that compulsory?
Yes, they do have to walk through it, yes, and it's sponsored
not just
by
if they get lost.
But one interesting thing from that press release, they said they've got 395 golf events around the world that can qualify for the Order of Merit. So you can get a world ranking in all of these. Of those, 13 are not 72 hole stroke play. So there's definitely room for different formats. And I like the idea. In fact, I've stolen it for my Saturday group. I've got eight guys who come to my Saturday clinic. And over the course of the year, over the course of the summer, we're doing a six-hole match play competition. But they've got to use six clubs. So I've actually stolen it. And I do think it's a great idea. I'm just not sure that this particular event was the great TV spectacle that it might have been.
Needs fine-tuning.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that part of doing the members' clinics or the coaching clinics is actually giving the student an opportunity to choose what they want to do during the session. You know, if they want to use three clubs only, or if they want to have a drink while they're playing, or you've got to make it as accessible and as fun for them as they possibly want. Otherwise, they're not going to return to the sport. You know, the other options, I think, for golf courses and during tournaments as well, you know, I use the stadium course in Phoenix as an example. You know, they have 20,000 people around that par three cheering, booing and singing players as they play that 16th hole. And it's become one of the most famous holes in tournament golf. I think that, you know, similar to Denmark, not only formats of play are going to help us depending on how good they are, but I think also the way that the sponsors and the host structure the golf tournaments themselves. You know, I think that you can create fantastic arenas around certain golf holes that create talking points and actually, you know, create interest in viewing figures.
Why wasn't it more successful as a spectacle this time round?
They didn't have the best players there, I didn't think, and it just lacked atmosphere. Again, Portugal were playing football, I understand, that day. So
quite a big game.
Yeah, quite a, you know, you know,
Nations
few,
League final.
A few people were quite interested in that, and in Portugal, it's not a big game, and in much of Europe, it's played by the moneyed classes, if you like, and it's quite unlike golf in Britain. The average man in the street doesn't really know much about the game, so they didn't really get the atmosphere, I didn't think, and it just didn't really translate. But I think it's more about I want to see Rory and Brooks do this. I don't necessarily think that it's a bad format.
No, but that's the point. And the comparisons to T20 cricket are obvious. But when England, for example, played T20, we see the big names still involved. We see the likes of Stokes, the likes of Josh Butler. Are we going to get to a point where the Rorys and the Brooks Koepkas are going to be involved?
Well, I think this is more a trial than anything. I mean, it was only played over 2 days. They haven't... I don't think they've quite worked it out yet, but what they're doing is trying to find things that do work. So once they hit upon a formula, and these things are always under review, and they're looking at ways of making it more exciting. I think that's a good idea. Is it quite right yet? No. Will it be better? Yes. Leave them to it. And I don't like the negativity of, oh, well, it was a rubbish tournament. No, I wouldn't say that. I think it's well worth trying, and I like the idea of it. And it's not the only tournament where men and women are playing together. They do that in the Victoria Open in Australia, and they've got quite a nice thing there where there's no gallery ropes either, so the crowd walk behind the players and they can watch the shot from behind, which I think is excellent, and actually how the way golf should be watched. If you watch from the side, you really do lose sight of the flight of the ball. You can't see the shape of it either, so you get a much better feeling from behind, and I think that's another nice innovation that will be taken up by other tournaments.
And I think another angle that the tour can use, obviously they have their ambassadors for the British Masters. You know, we had Tommy Fleetwood, we've had Justin Rose, and these guys obviously have a huge fan base themselves that they can draw to the event. And, I think a great idea for these guys. I mean, obviously we have appearance fees in golf. It's not spoken about too much, but it's very important that, you know, the bigger players in the world are actually involved in these smaller events to raise the profile of them. So I think that, you know, the European Tour can look to the players for their support like they have done for the British Masters. And hopefully if there's enough sponsorship and budget there, they can actually start to pay appearance fees to bring these guys and their fan base to these new tournaments. Mm.
One last thing on this. I think the scheduling for the majors, we talked about this last week, being condensed to April, May, June and July. There's a major in each one of those. It gives much more scope later on in the season for these more, you could call them novelty events or shortened formats. So I think the serious golf can be played now. And this is, again, a reason why I didn't really think that putting the sixes up against the Canadian Open this week and the US Open next week was such a great idea, but maybe with the compressing of the major championships, we'll see more of this in other times of the year.
Mm. Do you think it will never be viewed as serious golf?
It'll always be slightly gimmicky. I think it's not the main event, but equally, why would you want 72 holes of stroke play every single week? At our golf clubs, you don't play the monthly medal every week, you play it every month. And, you know, you play other interesting formats. They don't just play stroke play in the Ryder Cup, they play match play. It makes it more interesting. And it gets people away from what Alistair McKenzie, the great architect who designed Augusta National, called the card and pencil spirit of golf. He called it the meanness of the card and pencil. And we all know that golf is a really brutal game when played, when every shot counts. And other formats of the game are a lot more fun to play, and they can yield other kinds of golf. You can be more attacking, for example, in four ball. So at the Ryder Cup, you never get a more exciting week than the Ryder Cup. And why? Well, it's all match play, so they can play in a slightly more attacking way. They're only going to lose a hole rather than three, four shots if they make a double or a triple. So I want to see different formats. I want to see these guys do different things.
I think that also, you know, the match play side of things is so popular because it creates a story. You know, we want to see Tiger Woods playing against Brooks Koepka or Dustin Johnson playing against Brooks Koepka. And sometimes in the 72-hole stroke play events, having the top two players in the world coming down the stretch battling it out for the tournament is what creates the interest. Mm. So I still think it revolves around the players. I think the match play element is superb. I think it needs to be competitive in that sense because that's what gets the crowds entertained. And that's what I think produces the highest standard of golf from these players as well.
Yeah, you do get a different, for TV, a completely flipped level of interest on Thursday and Friday. For match play, Thursday and Friday are the best days because you get all these matches out all over the course. Really interesting matchups, and then of course you get fewer and fewer as the week goes on, and you never know. The top players, as we like to call them, might not play the best that week, and they might not get through to the final. So you can have a rather lacklustre final, and it doesn't have to be close either. So you can get a bit of a non-event as a final, whereas the stroke players can be quite dull. Did I really say that? Yes, I think I did. It can be quite dull for Thursday and Friday. And it certainly was at Bethpage Black. I got a lot of traction on social media by suggesting that actually the course setup at Bethpage Black had made Thursday and Friday actually rather dull. And then it came to life in the very last nine holes. It's the complete opposite of a match play event.
Of course, any sport is about drama. It's about interest, engagement. One man who is, of course, no stranger to drama or the front page is President Donald Trump. He likes his golf, but coming up, does he cheat? I hope the CIA aren't listening.
This is Love Sport.
We are honoured here in Britain because President Donald Trump has seen fit to visit our noble shores in the last week or so, and that much protested visit has also found time to take in a visit to Ireland and therein Doonbeg, a golf course that Trump, of course, owns, one of many. He managed to play, he managed to meet some local kids and deliver no doubt some wonderful pearls of wisdom. But does he cheat at golf?
Well, according to Rick Riley, who's an American journalist who's actually written a book about what golf tells us about Donald Trump, it's called Commander in Cheat. So I guess Rick thinks that he probably does. He's the kind of golfer that takes six, says fives, and writes four, by the sounds of it. In the words of Rick, he does golf just like he does being president, as if rules are for other people. And it's quite an interesting book. I don't know how seriously to take it, but one story is that the Donald says that he has 18 club championships to his name. And Rick said, yes, but he owns 18 golf clubs. And when they open, what he does, he plays around on his own. He calls that the first club championship. So he's the winner. Up it goes on the honours board. And there he is. He's at the top of the board. And nobody can take it away from him, they say, until Rick obviously writes a book about it.
But I'd do that. I mean, wouldn't you do that? That has got to be one of the merits of owning a golf course, is you can go, look how good I am. No one can challenge me.
I it wouldn't even occur to me to do that.
No, come off it.
Oh,
yes,
come on.
It would.
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't.
You wouldn't want your name on the board.
That's a different thing. Yeah, of course.
You'd want it there properly.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, one of the wonderful things about golf is that you are your own referee. Unlike other sports where actually you know, have to try and con somebody in a football match, and people actually approve of that. And there was one lovely story from the book about Donald playing with Brad Faxon, who's a semi-retired tour pro now and broadcaster, against Dustin Johnson and Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods hits one to an inch on a par four for two, so he's got a kick-in birdie. And while they're on the other side of the fairway, Donald hits one into the water and says to Brad, chuck me another ball. I don't think they saw that. Hits another one onto the green, and then they get to the green. And
they not hear the plop.
And they well, of course they did. And then they say, Donald says, well, how are we lying? And, well, Tiger's got a birdie. What are you putting for, Donald? Oh, I've got this for a par.
Yeah, definitely lying.
Yeah, exactly. So and Brad was is interesting. He said, yeah, I was almost hoping he would do that because that I can say I've seen it firsthand, and it's all true. So, yeah, that's how he does golf.
I wonder what Tiger Woods actually thinks about you know, Trump putting his name up on a board, because at golf clubs this is a sacred thing. I mean, your average golf club member will spend thousands on
but
golf
Tommy
lessons.
Won the championship fair and square. He got the best score. That's how this works.
Yeah, I think that's the way that Trump does things, and yeah, no one can do anything about it. But there's going to be so many club golfers at home thinking, God, we've had blood, sweat and tears in to get our name up on these boards. And Trump buys the golf course and he helps himself. So good for him.
I'm interested by this suggestion that the way in which someone plays golf could perhaps tell you more about them as a person. Do you think golf is a game of character?
Well, there was a book written actually in the 80s about this by Mark McCormack. Well, it was a part of What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School. And he wrote, yeah, no, instead of a job interview, just take them to play golf. And, you know, if
so you're not judging them in terms of the quality of their golf.
Oh, no. No. Just how they behave and how they act, and whether they're courteous, whether they show the right etiquette, whether they just do the right things.
What if they buy the golf course? What do
you do? Well, he could probably buy a couple of golf courses himself. Mark McCormick was a very good player, actually, played in the amateur championship. So I don't think he would have entertained Donald Trump for very long, in truth.
No, interesting stuff. I maintain that, okay, it's unsporting, but I would do it straight away. No question at all. If I bought the golf club, I can do what I want. And I'd also have my own buggy that goes very, very quickly. Let's touch as well on the ladies' PGA, because we talked about this last week with some very controversial comments. But what a performance from Lexi Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, she's already a veteran on the tour. She's 24 years old and she's been on tour for 9 years already. Turning professional at 15, she qualified.
Her childhood was fun.
Yeah, she had older brothers who are both very good players. And she was the younger girl that had to keep up with her big brothers. So her feet almost come off the ground at impact as she's hitting the driver, and she hits it hard because that's what she had to do growing up. I mean, she qualified for the US Open at 12 years old, which is just ridiculous. Because she was just that good. And
it's an astonishing watch, actually. She's what I would call a moving parts swing. I mean, she has a fairly normal backswing. And then the follow-through, it's a bit like Seve. Every follow-through is completely different. It's astonishing how she... And then you think, well, that's not going to be a good shot. And then suddenly it plops down by the hole, and it's a brilliant iron shot. You explain that to me. I don't know how she's doing that.
She doesn't have that kind of modern day robotic look to her golf swing. She's learned to play golf on the golf course, and she's learned to play golf with people that are better players than her. So she's had to just figure it out. Mm. And I think that she's got good through sheer determination and amazing hand-eye coordination.
It's almost like a female Bubba Watson. I mean, a different kind of swing, but the same way of playing. Really natural. And not mechanical, like you do see a lot of players on the LPGA Tour, the very slow, rhythmical swings, and very orthodox. And she's just nothing like that.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, she's got a power game too. But what I was impressed about yesterday was that she does have a strong driver game. You know, she hits the ball a long way in the ladies' game, but she actually didn't use her driver once in the final round. She selected three woods. She got the ball in the fairway. It was a very windy, bouncy golf course. She put the ball in the right place, and she was rewarded with a 20-footer on the last for eagle. And then she has a long wait in the clubhouse and on the putting green, pacing up and down, waiting for all the other ladies to come in and finish. And nobody got ahead of her. So that's her 11th professional title at 24 years old.
I mean, and she's not afraid to show her emotions either. After every shot, you know exactly what she thinks of it. I like that too, when they wear their heart on their sleeves a bit, like Tiger did and many others have done before her. But no, hats off to her. I think she's great.
Exactly. And the hero of last week, you know, Lee Six, comes in at second place, another 160,000 towards the family money tree. And, you know, again, she's playing amazing golf. She's now, you know, she's ranked 6 in the world. Lexi ranked 4 in the world. I think the ladies' game is looking really strong. And, you know, the event last week was entertaining. It was a bit like Canada. There was a fantastic finish with big players coming down the stretch. And it was a really exciting one to watch.
Wonderful to view. And, of course, you mentioned there Thompson's emotion, the way that which she's not afraid to reveal how she's feeling. Golf's a very emotional sport. It's a very high-pressure sport. And, of course, when you don't feel able to let those emotions out, it can be a very, very mentally taxing sport to be involved with. Thomas Bjorn has got a book coming out talking about this. He's been talking to The Guardian as well. And coming up, we'll be talking about just how hard a sport golf is to be involved with psychologically as well as physically.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to Straight Down the Middle here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed and Jeremy Dale. And we're talking about Thomas Bjorn's attitude to golf and the struggles he's had with mental health whilst part of the game. He's got a book coming out written with Michael Calvin called Mind Game, and it focuses on the psychological trauma he suffered as a golfer. Book opens with Bjorn staring at himself in the mirror. His eyes are filled with tears, and he asks a series of stark questions. Why are you crying? Why do you put yourself through this pain? Why do you play this game? Do you really want to continue? Just how hard a game is this to be involved with at the highest level?
Well, it's hugely psychological. I mean, you know, you can get in your own way. This is a term that we talk about a lot in golf and in performance. You can get in your own way. And Thomas Bjorn, you know, this isn't a metaphorical thing. He was having conversations with himself in the mirror. He was trying to talk to himself to actually understand why he was feeling so low. You know, why all of a sudden a game that he's loved his entire life does he actually start to hate? I think it's because he's put a lot of pressure on himself to perform, like most do. And, you know, he was defined by some in his career as the guy that threw away the British Open, a bit like Jean van der Velde. I mean, you know, he's hit this tee shot on 16 at Royal St. George's in the British Open. He's got a two-shot lead. And 6 inches to the left, this ball's 6 feet away from the hole for a birdie. It goes 6 inches to the right, falls into a pot bunker. He takes three to get out, makes double bogey and loses the British Open. And
how do you come back from that?
Well, you know, he's won 21 times globally. He's won 3 Ryder Cups and he was an amazing captain at Le Golf National last year. And, you know, I think that he struggled to come back from that because, you know, he was the margins in sport are so fine. And this one, sadly for him, has defined him a little bit as a player. And I think that he started to believe his own press. And that's when he started
his
to spiral.
His own negative press.
His own negative press, yeah. You know, he knew that he was in 2-shot lead where this ball, if it stays on the green, he's got a birdie putt to go 3 ahead with 2 to play. And, you know, he makes history. He holds one of the oldest championships in golf. And he's in that elite group of players that is a major champion. And what it means to be a major champion for these guys is almost everything. And, you know, obviously for Bjorn, he's gone through some highs and some lows. And, you know, he has this persona of a grumpy man, sometimes looks a little moody. But actually, I've had a few interactions with him, and he's a very soft, kind, gentle guy. He is quite straightforward. Quite straight talking, but I think he's done wonderful things for golf in Europe, contributing to 3 winning Ryder Cups as a player and then captaining one in that emphatic victory that we had last year as Team Europe. You know, and it's fantastic to see him coming forward because within this book as well, you've got guys like Fleetwood, Justin Rose, Keimer and Stenson all talking about their struggles with mental health and how they've got over them. And I do hope that these guys will actually start to act as role models and inspirations for others who can relate to the problems that they go through.
How widespread a problem do you think this is in golf?
I think it's huge. You know, you look at the players that have gone from world number one plummeting outside of the top 200 and then they've tried to claw their way back. These guys are used to being at the top of the game. You know, Tiger Woods only knows a world where he's dominant and he wins competitions and all of a sudden he's lying on his back and he can't even hit a putt for 7 months. You know, it takes an awful lot of mental fortitude to be able to pick yourself up and get back up and win these golf tournaments. And, you know, you have to take into account all of the variables that these guys go through as well. It's the time travel, obviously the different time differences, the flights, all of the difficulties with the golf course, all of the players they're playing against. Sometimes there's some comments from the crowds that can upset people. There's a huge amount of variables that they have to consider. And I think that, you know, only the toughest of the tough don't go through a spell in their career where they hit a real low in their mood. And I think it's wonderful that someone with a high profile, especially off the back of the Ryder Cup, has actually come out to help create some awareness for a lot of other guys and not just golfers. You know, there's a huge topic of conversation at the moment is mental health and how amazing the awareness is now for it. And more people are coming forward. And I think this book is going to be the start of a big thing for that.
Well, there's a telling quote from Bjorn in this article in The Guardian. He says, when you're a young man, you hide your feelings. You keep pushing it away until you can't do it anymore. I finally realised I had to get everything out. Now, not just in golf, but for men more broadly. How much do you think not talking about it is part of the cause of this?
100%, because, you know, it's supposedly it's not masculine for men to talk about their feelings and show emotion. And, you know, I think that stigma is starting to be removed now. I think players are starting to show more emotion and come forwards. And I think that the more players, like the huge names in Keimer, Stenson, Rose and Fleetwood, some of the biggest names in golf are coming forward and talking about their mental health issues. And I think that all that's going to do is breed more and more people coming forward about it, which will be much better for everyone else. And, you know, we look at our sportsmen and women as heroes, as figures of inspiration.
As superhuman somehow.
That's right. That's right. And to see them showing that weakness, that emotional weakness, I think is only going to be good for the wider public, because even for me as a huge golf fan, to be able to read that, you know, I can resonate and I can also, you know, I can sort of just feel his pain in some ways, because I've played professional golf and I know how tough it is when, you know, that tournament and that round of golf means the world to you and it doesn't work out the way you want it to. You've got to be tough in your head to be able to regroup, get yourself back up there and go and play again with positivity.
Yeah, when you get a bad result, you've almost exclusively focused on performance. And one of the more interesting books in the 80s was the first golf psychology book written by a guy called Timothy Galway called The Inner Game of Golf. And in that, he talked about the performance-learning triangle. So the triangle is performance, enjoyment, and learning. If you focus exclusively on performance, which is actually where golf does lead you, then you don't enjoy it very much and you don't learn very much. It's a bit like the opposite is true if you go just purely for enjoyment. So you've got beers on the cart and you go with your mates for a round.
Good so
you're
far.
Not going to perform very well and you might probably won't learn anything either. So you've got to have those performance, enjoyment and learning in balance. And I think professional sport generally is a really neurotic existence. Mike Atherton wrote about this in his book. Byron Nelson used to throw up before each round, and he was a guy that won 5 majors and 11 tournaments in a row in the 50s. And Paul Azinger talked about the same thing. So this is not a new problem, and it's incredibly stressful to turn up to a golf event thinking that you're the one that should win. I've never actually felt that in a proper golf tournament, but I have felt it in a trick shot tournament. We had a world championships for trick shots, for golfing trick shots, and I've never been as nervous in my life, except when Seve was watching me do a show. And it's a really difficult thing to get through. And I think golf in particular would bring this out. And I'm surprised, actually, almost that it hasn't happened earlier. Because in golf, every shot counts equally, which is not true of, say, tennis, where you have big points where you can, or points where you're down in a game that don't really matter, so you can hit some free forehands if you're 40 love down, because obviously the game is pretty well up. You don't share the ball in golf with your opponent, so you're entirely responsible for what happens to it. Nor can you hide after the match behind the invincible opponent. I can lose 6-1, 6-1, 6-1 to somebody in tennis and go, well, he had an amazing day. Whereas in golf, if you shoot 85, 85, 85, 85, you go, well, that wasn't anybody else's fault bar mine. And one of the other things about golf is that you initiate the action. Now, we all know from the England game against third place final, help me out.
Switzerland.
Thank you very much. That penalties are the most stressful part of a football match. Well, in golf, every shot's a penalty shot. And it counts. It matters where it finishes. So golf is hugely, hugely difficult technically, but also the structure of the game leads to, I think, enormous stress. Plus, as an individual pro, you don't get paid if you miss the cut. You have to organise all your travel, everything yourself. And no surprise, I think, that the bigger players, the ones that can afford it, have built a team around them. And you hear Danny Willett and Jordan Spieth talking about we. Because what they're trying to do there, I think, is get the feeling that they're not alone, that they have a whole team around them, and they may get criticised for having a mental coach, a putting coach, a swing coach, a fitness coach by the older generation. But actually, you can kind of see why they would do it.
I mean, and that's a great point, because this is an individual sport, so they create a team around them that makes them feel that they're part of something bigger. Brooks Koepka travels with the same people every week. He has the chef, he has his girlfriend, he has his caddy, he has his coach, and he has his fitness guy. And they do the same thing every week because he demands that sort of consistency, because otherwise he won't be able to perform in a consistent manner.
I hope his girlfriend likes golf, by the way.
I think she does. Yeah,
well, at
absolutely.
Least that the food is really good.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, she's always at the sidelines cheering him on and giving him a kiss and a cuddle at the end of it.
The important thing is she likes Brooks, I think. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, she's done quite well there, isn't she? I mean, they're probably living a good life, the two of them, at
you
the moment.
I thought so, yeah. In terms of what golf can do as a sport, as an institution, to help its players, male and female, deal with the psychological side of things, how can they involve themselves positively?
Well, I think, you know, I can speak from a coach's point of view. You know, a lot of the time when students come in for a golf lesson, we actually spend a lot of the time talking rather than hitting the ball, because there's a certain technical standard that you can get to that makes the ball go in a relatively repeatable flight. But it gets to the point where you can get in your own way. Your mental process can become flawed, and you can have no consistency in your mental process, therefore no consistency in your game. And we spend a lot of time talking about staying in the present. Nick Fowler used to say one foot in front of the other so that he could stay in the present. Justin Rose has a fantastic mental game trick where if he has a bad start to his round, he draws a line on the scorecard through those holes and he starts all over again. So I think that the game can have a positive effect on your mental health, depend on how serious you take win or lose. And I think ultimately if the players focus heavily on their process and their enjoyment of the game, they will be healthy mentally.
There is an inherent problem with this at the top level because they're all responsible for themselves. And there is no team. I mean, if you're on the England cricket team, there'll be somebody who can help you, and your teammates are actually on your side. In golf, if you shoot a bad score and you go into the clubhouse moaning about it, then half of them don't care, and the other half wish that you'd shot more. So you know, there's no structure in place in professional golf for that, unless the tour start laying on counselling. Which they may do. I don't know. They may already do that. When they started laying on a gym for the players to use, that was seen as pretty radical. So there's no reason why they can't go a step further, and maybe they should.
Absolutely, and the golf psychologist is part of the team now. You know, there's some more famous names out there, the Bob Rattellas, who've produced, you know, some of the most amazing literature on golf psychology. But I think a big thing for the players, and I've been in this world where I've had a bad round and I've gone to the hotel room and not wanted to talk to anybody, and that's when it gets difficult. That's when you start to remove yourself from social occasions because you've got the hump and you don't want to have a discussion about golf because you're fed up from it from the round. That's when things start to spiral. You can get into that room service attitude. So I think the important thing is that you remain sociable and that you remain in company. And that's where I think the team has its biggest strength, that you have the same people treating you the same way, whether you shoot 65 or 75. Mm.
And above all, going back to Bjorn's comments, you've got people to talk to as well, which is massively important. Sounds like a very interesting read. It's certainly a very good interview. And hopefully everyone involved with golf will feel that they can engage with their emotions in a way that is healthy and productive. And the pressure, of course, is non-stop. It's going to continue this week. The US Open at Pebble Beach is set to start. And coming up, let's preview it. Who's going to be tip for it? I suspect, talking of pressure, big things will be expected of Rory.
This is Love Sport.
Straight down the middle here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, Tom Reed and Jeremy Dale. And the US Open is coming up at Pebble Beach. It's a tricky course and it's time for a brand new feature here on the Golf Show, Through the Keyhole. See what I did there? What are the keyholes on this course? Where could players slip up?
Well, I've picked two keyholes. They're both par threes, actually. One is fascinating, especially if we get wind. It's the seventh hole. And it's the kind of hole actually that if that course was built now that might not make it onto the 18 hole plan. It's only 109 yards long. It goes downhill, and it has like an infinity green. There's just ocean, and it's on a cliff.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so you're teeing off perhaps into the wind with a shot which could be fairly high spinning with a short iron or a wedge or a sand wedge or a lob wedge for these guys. But if there's a bit of wind, you've got to hit this short shot and judge the distance exactly right with something like a 6 or 7 iron if it's blowing an absolute hoolie. And we've seen that in the past, actually. In 1992, there was an absolute gale and Tom Kite won. And that was one of the holes where he hit an amazing... I think he chipped in on that hole. So that's a hole that's seen a lot of drama, but it's a really, really tricky hole. If the wind blows. If it doesn't, it's just a little flick, but it's a really small green. And I once knew a course architect, actually, who deliberately would build an 80-yard hole on a course and make a tiny green. And he described that as one of the most terrifying shots that you could give a professional golfer because it's less than a full swing. And the judgment of distance was almost more difficult than if you had double the distance. Which brings me on to the other keyhole, which is the 17th, which has also seen some drama. In 1972, Nicklaus came to that hole, hit a one iron into the wind, 208 yards, so almost double the length, and hit the flagstick. not bad. And he said it afterwards that, oh, I just saved it at the right at the bottom. I just saved it with a movement of my hand.
Took hands. A little bit
off. No, it just saved the shot from being a disaster. And it was so good that it rifled through the wind and hit the flagstick. 10 years later, he was undone actually by a chip in on that same hole by Tom Watson. Again, who hit a 2-iron and just hooked it a bit, but managed to chip it in from fairly close range. But one of the great shots in golf and a great celebration as well. And it's so those are two halves. I mean, the 18th is much longer, but it has like a figure of eight green, and it's changed quite a lot. It's got quite a lot smaller. And it could be a really pivotal hole because it's just really difficult. It's not a great design, as are quite a few of the holes at Pebble Beach, but the scenery is just stunning. It is one of the most beautiful courses that you'll ever see, and you've got this run of holes from the 5th to the 8th, and then the 9th and 10th and the 17th and the 18th that all run along the ocean, and they're all clifftop as well. So, and interestingly, it's a public course. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it costs over $600 to play there, so,
right.
So it's not readily accessible, but it is actually a public course, and it's the only public course to be voted the number one golf course in America. That's the only time it's ever happened. Mm. So it's an interesting place, and it played a role in getting Alistair McKenzie the job designing Augusta National. In the 1929, I mean, this is a bit of a red herring, but I think all the stuff's quite interesting. In 1929, they had the US amateur there, and Bobby Jones, who was the leading player of the day, professional or amateur, got knocked out in the first round and went to visit Cypress Point, which is down the road, which is probably a better golf course, but a very private club. And I was so impressed that he said, well, who designed this? And they introduced him to Alistair McKenzie, and Jones said, well, actually, I'm building a course.
And the rest,
why don't
say.
You come and help me design it? And he did. And
and
they never paid him for it either, which was a bit cheeky. But that was in the height of the Depression. But anyway, it's a course with a lot of history. It's had five US Opens, and the winners have been quite different. Nicklaus, Tiger, Watson, Tom Kite, and G-Mac. And it had a PGA in 1977, and Lanny Watkins won that. So it's had some amazing history. It's produced really great winners, but the two key holes for me, 7th and 17th, I'll be watching those with interest.
High drama on those holes, rich history. Tom, hearing the kind of course it is, what kind of player are you expecting to succeed?
Well, I think two of the players who are previous champions, we've got Tiger Woods and Graham McDowell, both come back into form. Graham McDowell obviously won this event last time. It was at Pebble Beach in 2010. He made a par on the last on Father's Day in America, and his dad stood there on the side of the green, and amazing Father's Day present for him. But Graham McDowell comes back in good form. He's the type of player that will do well on that golf course. He controls the distance of his irons very well, which is integral at Pebble Beach. The greens are small and firm, and you need to be able to do that. But the main man for me is Tiger Woods. You know, in 2000, he had one of the most dominant performances that we've ever seen in a major championship. 19 years ago, it was the 100th US Open in the year 2000. He won by 15 shots, and this was at the height of Tiger Mania. Bjorn described it as near to as perfect golf as he's ever seen. And Bjorn actually has a fantastic story. He said that he hit an errant drive on the 10th hole and had to go outside of the galleries to find his ball and chip it back onto the fairway. And then the galleries wouldn't actually let him back in onto the fairway because they had no idea who he was. They were so engrossed in Tiger Woods that they'd completely forgotten who his playing partner was.
That is quite something.
Absolutely. And you know, Tiger comes into this event, I think, in really good shape. Mm. He's had his week off, his preparation week, which he prefers. Week beforehand, he had a top 10 finish, hitting a lot of great shots. So I think Jordan Spieth, also fantastic putter and iron player. I think, you know, McDowell, Woods, Spieth, they're the three guys I'm looking to this week.
I like your choice of Tiger, actually, because he's a great iron player, and the course is only a couple of hundred yards longer than it was when Graham McDowell won it 9 years ago. So I think, and Brooks Koepka, for example, has said that he's only hit driver three or four times around, maybe five at the most. So if you're hitting a lot of long irons and the greens are small and you're a really good iron player, then I like Tiger's chances. It's a kind of course that does reward different kinds of players, and it really depends, I think, on the weather and also the setup. It's the kind of course, because it's not so long, that it could produce a completely different kind of player, like a Tom Kite, like a G-Mac. Mm. So, I mean, when I'm tipping players, I really don't like to go for, you know, the obvious ones. So here's a couple of each way ideas. Jim Furyk. Mm. Nobody hits it straighter. In fact, as captain of the Ryder Cup, he was. You were thinking actually he would be doing a pretty better job of getting around Golf National with its narrow fairways and than half the team. Danny Willett coming into form, had a nice finish in Canada and has two good major champions to his back. And he's the kind of guy that if he gets a sniff, he will really, really do well. I like, as Tom said, Spieth, because he's come back into form. But the other guy who's ruined it by winning the Memorial for me was Patrick Cantlay.
He's trending, Jeremy.
It's a bit. Yeah, well, he actually did a fairly cheesy video about how difficult and deep the rough was.
And ironically, he dropped the ball in a hazard. So yeah, which, someone should remind him he can take a free drop from there.
Here are the rules. Yeah, exactly. But I like Cantlay, Willett and Jim Furyk as outsiders with Spieth and Tiger. You couldn't argue against either.
Wonderful. We've just got a minute left, gents. And it would be remiss of us not to mention the USGA. They run the US Open. They haven't always got it right.
Do you know, their big problem is that they've got this 280 number as the winning score in their heads, and they feel like they've got to set the course up so difficultly that the winner has that score. And once you try and manipulate the winning score, I think you're in trouble. And they have been, they've been the story on a couple of occasions, most notably in 2004 in Shinnecock, and then they promised they wouldn't do it again. And then and in 2018 last year, they did it again. They got the greens too quick. They didn't take the weather into account. They had the craziness of calling a penalty on Dustin Johnson, and they're not. Let's hope they're not the story.
Absolutely. Let's hope they take a back seat and some of these wonderful golfers can step to the floor instead in, of course, the US Open at Pebble Beach. This has been Straight Down the Middle on Love Sport Radio. You'll have to join us next week for a review.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.